in this other place, then I had to give up this hope, finding the truth about Buddha's life. It was fine, there was still his teaching, which is quite fine and interesting, much to learn. Doesn't matter if I don't have a very clear picture about Buddha's life. Then I inquire a little bit into mythology. And then I started to see how interesting it was, that a mythological way of telling a story was much more rich than a historical way. Because a history just tell me about one person, his deeds, his birth and what he did, and his death. But it's only good for him. It's fine, it's good for him. I'm not concerned with that. While reading mythology, that's something different. Because through mythology, a history is told in a way that it is a truth, universal truth, which apply to every one of us. Suddenly reading the Buddha's life as mythology, it started to be much more interesting. Then I could see that was not only applying to Siddhartha, the young prince who got enlightened, but maybe to anybody trying also to awaken. And there were many elements in the Buddha's life, how it was told, that may apply to each one of us. Then I like to tonight tell the story of the Buddha in a way that may also apply to anybody seeking truth or seeking freedom, to see what are the main elements in Buddha's life, how it is told, that may apply also to us. The first element, depends where one starts, but when the Buddha was born, very young baby, he was brought to astrologer who look at the sign and the stars, numbers, and say that this young baby would either become a universal king or fully awakened. So he saw that from the stars, from the numbers, from whatever. And that is the beginning of the Buddha's life and Buddha's life history. So what does he say, you know? Should we imagine that at this time in India they had fantastic astrologers and people who really were very competent? Maybe we should go through Jerusalem or Tel Aviv and try to find somebody who can tell us what we will become when we will be old. You know, maybe some people are very skillful. I remember a story in Kabir, this Indian poet, writer, when he met his guru. He was, the story says, he was on a tree and he was cutting a branch, but he was seated on the wrong part, which means that he was going to fall. And this sage came underneath and said, "You are going to fall." And Kabir said, "Why?" And then he cut the branch and fall. So this sage was not really skillful in reading in the future. He just saw exactly what could happen. Now we may wonder if this astrologer did not actually give a prophecy which was as obvious as the teacher of Kabir saying that he was going to fall. Because when he said that this young child will either become a universal king or fully awakened, what really was he referring to? Maybe he was referring to the potentiality that is in each one of us. the potentiality to become a universal king, you would say, not too much chance nowadays. Well, mythology usually express with outside symbol what is happening within oneself. And maybe universal king or fully awakened refer to things quite similar, yet seen in a very slightly different way. A universal king may be also just a potentiality to live a life completely, fully, not to rule over all the other people, but to possess every aspect of oneself and to really experience one's life in completeness. Then that is a potentiality that is in each one of us. There is nothing within us which can prevent us from that. We can all experience our life in a full way with a sense of completeness. Now the other aspect, that the Buddha would become fully awakened, that's the potentiality which is in each one of us, beyond completeness, to reach total freedom. Not to even cling to this completeness and go deeper and see that we are completely free, not holding to anything. Then this astrologer was not much more wise than the teacher of Kabir, seeing that he was going to fall, because he just said something which is obvious for all of us, that if we really want to claim what is our wealth and to get what is ours, it is here. It belongs to us, completeness and total freedom. Nobody here is not endowed with this potentiality. No need to go to the astrologer in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv. I can tell you that each one of us may attain fulfillment or freedom if one can connect deeply within oneself to our own nature. This is connected with the nature of our mind. The nature of our mind being clear and knowing, and all the other aspects like aversion, desire, all the confusion are just like clouds going through the sky. They cannot affect the nature, the essence of our mind. Then, which means that if we let the wind blow, the clouds will go away and our fulfillment, our completeness and our ultimate freedom will just be very clear, and that we will experience it. That belongs to, if it's a proper word, each one of us. We don't need to get it from anybody else. No place where, we don't need to go to India to get it. Nowhere. So that's what this astrologer said about the very young prince, that he would either become a universal king or fully awakened. That's what ultimately we all will become. Now the young prince was brought up in a nice and rich family in northern India, and his father was a king according to the mythology, and then the young prince lived in a very happy way, being surrounded with beautiful things and being well educated, having excellent food, many musicians, dancers, and we can imagine all the most beautiful way of spending a worldly life. Then he even got a wife that he had to win through some contests, so at least give him a sense of worthiness, you know. It is They just did not bring his wife like that, but he had to win it, you know, through archery and wrestling and different things like that. Then finally he was the best, and then got his princess as a wife. Then he lived very happily in his palace, enjoying life. Being endowed with so much possessions, rooms, certainly beautiful clothes, gold and whatever we can imagine. There were no cars at this time, neither airplane, but all the other things he had, elephants, rich elephants, white elephants, all those things, certainly he had. Nothing more he could wish for. That's also a way of seeing the Buddha in his early life, accepting all the value of society that his father was giving to him. The value of having, the value of society, the value of family, the value of being a prince, and to become a king. To have education, to know archery and certainly the art of war, if he had to become a king. And then at this first part in his life, the Buddha just, it seems, accepted all those values, not questioning them. And that's what his father wanted. Usually fathers do not like to be questioned on their values. Then he tried by many ways to avoid anything that could raise questions in the young prince Siddhartha's mind. And it went on well for some years. And the young prince once wanted to discover his kingdom and ask the permission to his father to go out. Then they brought a chariot, and the charioteer drove the Buddha, or the prince, if you wish, outside of the city. And the first encounter that happened to the young prince was that he saw somebody very sick, very weak, and having fever and all the sign of sickness. And the prince asked the charioteer, "What is wrong with this man? You know, why does he look like that?" The charioteer answered that this man was affected by sickness, by illness, and that could happen to any one of us, even to the young prince. And it seems that the young prince was shocked. Imagine how naive he was. He was shocked and immediately wanted to go back to the king's palace. Sometime later, again he wanted to discover more of his kingdom, then he asked the permission to go out. And he said that the second time he saw a very old man, very weak, you know, affected by old age. And when he asked the charioteer what was wrong with this man, he said, "It's just old age, and all the power of the body is going away, and that will be the fate of any human being. Even the young prince will one day be like that." And again he was shocked, and immediately he went back to the palace. The third time when he went out, he said that he saw a procession of people carrying a corpse, a dead body, and they were weeping and crying, being very affected by the loss of their father or grandfather or husband. The prince again asked the charioteer, who told him that the people were very sad and they were crying and weeping because they had lost a father, a grandfather, husband, and they will never meet him again, and that he was being brought to the fire to be burned. You know. Then he was shocked and went back to the palace. The fourth time he went out, he saw a man walking very peacefully, very quietly, with much serenity. Maybe with shaved head and dress, we don't know in which color, because we cannot imagine a monk like in Buddha's order, because Buddha's order, of course, was not yet founded. So maybe it was different colors, pink or blue, whatsoever. Anyway, the Buddha was, or the prince Siddhartha was, touched. Seeing how calm was this man, I was speaking the other day how they seldom do we meet somebody in a city when we walk across a city, and then we just see somebody being alive and completely in front of us. We have always a feeling that we just see some kind of ghost running everywhere, because everybody is so much preoccupied and projecting themselves where they have to go, what they have to do. And suddenly if you stop there and you look, and it's very rare that you meet somebody. You look and you hope to meet somebody, somebody will just look at you and you say, there is another human being here. It's difficult. It seems a very simple thing, but it's difficult. I remember once in India, I was crossing a small village and I was bothered by beggars. And I think they made a game of bothering me, so they can be very insistent, especially when they want to play with that, you know, and just bothering me. And then I was getting upset. And came a man, very quiet, and he said, "Hey, brother, just be peaceful. The peace is much more important than the few coins you could give to those beggars." It was very striking. He was just another being completely there. First he called me back to being here, and he was just there in front of me. Very touching, some other being there. In our cities, we don't meet so many people like that. And we may imagine the Buddha meeting this monk or this religious man, suddenly being struck by something different, by the value of this mind and the quietness, the calm behavior of this monk. So he went back to the palace. And of course he could not see anymore what he was seeing before, maybe with some kind of pleasure or satisfaction. Something had been broken in his mind. He did not trust anymore the value that his father wanted to impose on to him. He did not have same expectation and trust. There was, in his vision of his world, there was some breach, some crack. Then he was disturbed. He could not just stay in his palace and forget about it. He said that then those visions were certainly working on him and questioning his vision of the world. So this second aspect in Buddha's life is sometimes called the call to destiny. It's like in the hero's journey. First the heroes accept all the value that is given to him by society, and suddenly something is wrong. Something is just, you know, in his daily routine, something is out of place, which just calls his attention and says, the way you see the world is not proper. Then he has to question deeper. He cannot just go back to the same old way of seeing the world, not the same value can be given to his vision of the world. There is no more peace and satisfaction just by old ways and old expectations. So in all of us, there may have been some crack somewhere, some call to destiny. What in our life suddenly brought us to a meditation course? Think that that's fine, the way I see life and the way I experience my life, but maybe there is something more. Maybe not only what the TV is giving me, you know, all those values that are given to us so many times, or the newspaper, or maybe friends and family speak with, so important to get higher degree, education, money, houses. That's fine, but maybe there is something more. Maybe there is something else. So for each one of us, there has been some call for destiny, somewhere. Sometimes it's through deep suffering. Sometimes it's through a way of questioning, wanting to know. I want to know what is the truth of this world. I want to know why we are born and why we have to die. And there may be deep question leading each one of us to try to look a little bit deeper. find maybe what could appear in this crack or in this breach of our vision of the world. It is difficult when this skull has arisen just to forget about it. Like the prince could not forget about it, could not just stay in his palace. Suddenly he had to find some solution. He says the prince was not happy anymore, and his father could see that something was wrong. And Siddhartha asked his father the permission to leave, to start a spiritual research and spiritual quest. And the father said, no, don't leave. I'll give you anything you ask. Then the prince asked his father that he would never become sick, never become old, and never die. And if his father could give him that, he would stay. Of course, his father could not grant that to his son. Then the prince decided to leave and to really start to look for some answers. It is said that by some power of the gods, one night everybody fell asleep in the palace. All the guards were sleeping, everybody was sleeping, and then the prince could escape, leave the palace. Maybe they were all asleep, maybe they always have been asleep, because they were always concerned so much in their dream, fascinated by just more having, more dreams, more singing, more food. And we could also imagine in our society the prince very slowly walking out and nobody noticing that the prince is going out. You know? Everybody being so much busy with their own preoccupation. You know? Anyway, Siddhartha left this king's house and went out to look for deeper answer, deeper meaning in his life. And maybe the first thing that he did, he went to study with a teacher of the time. There were many teachers, and we may imagine he did practice first yoga and concentration. There were many skillful teachers at this time. Practicing concentration, then he, certainly being very good meditator and very, very skillful, experienced all the different levels of concentration, practicing with much sincerity. And in those stages of concentration, there are experiences which are arising, which are blissful and very, very deep happiness. Which is said that at the third stage, one reaches happiness, that it is the highest happiness that anybody could ever experience. Even the gods do not experience higher happiness than the one which is reached at the third stage, when the mind is so peaceful, so serene, there is no, at this time, no suffering, no distraction, no tension, no limitation, because there is just the object of concentration. There is no even sense of a meditator, of a self. It's just very blissful state. Then certainly the Buddha did experience that and higher, all those states of concentration which were taught at this time. And we could imagine in this highest bliss that reaching being a universal king. It is the deepest fulfillment within still a worldly life. Getting to the highest happiness that one could ever reach in this world. Then the Buddha reached those stages and he saw that they were not ultimate freedom. He had become, if you wish, universal king, and he saw that was not the answer he wanted. That was not good enough for him, because that was still depending on conditions. The condition being that his mind should not be distracted. That if he would go out of his meditation, again in the world, his mind would become again distracted, agitated, and this deep peace will be gone. He saw that was not ultimate freedom. That was not ultimate peace that he was looking for. Then he was not attracted even to this universal king state. It is said that for the meditators it is very difficult not to be attached to this state. Then the renunciation which is needed to go on in the spiritual development or spiritual journey is very strong. The power of renunciation is very strong. Then the Buddha had this power and went on and wanted to find deeper solution, deeper freedom. In the hero's journeys, it is expressed sometimes when the hero goes through many difficulties, and then at some place there is a beautiful princess there. You know, said you don't need to go to the end of your journey. You just stay with me. I'm in a beautiful place. And the hero's temptation is to stop halfway. Say, okay, why not? I'll stay here. That's fine. And I have a new life and happiness I was looking for. The temptation in the hero's journey is to stop halfway, because he finds something which seems quite good, not the aim of his journey, but to be satisfied halfway. Then the Buddha did not get satisfied halfway. He wanted to look deeper and find ultimate freedom. He went on, certainly left those teachers of concentration, and then tried something else. He tried mortification. He tried to inflict suffering to his own body. We may imagine, as it is still practiced nowadays in India, standing for days and days without sitting, till the leg become very big and harming the body. And some people in India, they keep their arm up, never bringing it down, and you see their arm out just like some dry branches. Very strange to see that. They have taken the precept of never putting their hands or arms down. Many ways of bringing more suffering to the body. It's not said that the Buddha did practice this or that aspect, but we may imagine in these 6 years that the Buddha spent practicing mortification, he may have tried many things like that, and also eating very little, till finally he got just to eat 1 grain of rice a day, and his body became so weak. There is a beautiful statue in Lahore Museum where maybe you have seen a picture of it, where we see the Buddha with all the part of his body and the vein and all the bones, due to the practice of only eating very little, 1 grain of rice a day. Then when he wanted to go to the river to wash his body, he could nearly not get out of the water, so weak he was. Then he decided that was not the way to make the mind and body very weak. That was not the way. Not the way to freedom. But the second part of greed renunciation, he had to renounce highest bliss. If you wish universal kingdom and also mortification, to go on the other extreme, rather than enjoying highest bliss, even to inflict to oneself much suffering, that did not bring any more freedom. How to connect that to our practice? What is the renunciation that we are cultivating coming to a retreat? In a sense, we all had to leave our home and to come to this place and letting things behind us that maybe were more comfortable and more distracting, more easy to deal with, sometimes more complicated to deal with, but there is a sense that some value that we were maybe cherishing get rich, not a way to get more houses, not a way to get husband and wife, usually. We won't come out of the retreat with more possession, with more having. Then we have to give up this value, which are usually promoted in our society of accumulation. When you explain to your friend or father, mother, husband, wife, why you come to retreat, it's not always easy to make oneself understandable. They wonder, but you know, what is the profit, what is the benefit? They wonder, you know, why you go and spend, at least go by the sea, you can swim, you know, or you know, something. Why you go there? It's very difficult. And often one gets tired to try to explain them, because there's no way to explain what maybe is driving us to come here. Some element of renunciation is needed to come to retreat. Some shifting from different values, the value of society, the value of having, to a value of being, just being. And the value of being is something difficult to explain to people who have not any experience of it. They don't understand what it means. What do you mean by being? I am, and so what? Very difficult. That may be interesting to see that we always need some amount of renunciation. It's not possible to come to retreat without leaving anything behind. And we have done that this time, and we are doing it every time you come to practice here, sitting or walking. You could just go to your room and read some nice novel. Yet you come here and sit, so there's some amount of renunciation. And next time we want to do another retreat, they still again need to bring some, the power of renunciation. I will leave behind some aspect of the value of what I do cultivate, what I do practice usually, to discover new things. That's the price we have to cost, the cost we have to pay every time. Just leaving something behind. It's very rare that we can just come here without paying any price. And we will have to do it again and again. That's where our hero's mind is called for. You know, I will give up that for 5 days, 6 days. Then the Buddha went on, after practicing these mortifications, seeing that was not leading to ultimate freedom. Then he went to sit, he took some food to get some energy within himself and to restore the health to his body. And then he went to sit under a tree at Bodh Gaya. Then he decided that he had to go alone, and he had to really finally go all the way to his destiny. Not to stop, not to ask other the way, but he really wanted to go all the way through. And when he sat down, he decided that he was not going to rise from his seat before he had found the answer. That he had been looking for long enough. Now he wanted some answer. When he sat under the Bodhi tree, then, of course, his mind started also to work, and doubts arose. Who are you? Doubts arose in his mind. Who are you to pretend to find the deepest truth and ultimate freedom? Doubt arises. Is it pride which made the Buddha at this time sit under the Bodhi tree and said, I am going to find the truth that nobody is teaching in India at this time, that nobody has found. I am going to find it. So there was some doubt. And it is said that it touched the earth. And then the earth goddess came and witnessed all the past life of the Buddha while he had been starting to look for answers. He has spent many, many years, 500 years, always as a spiritual seeker, trying to find the ultimate truth. And now that was a proper time for him to go through the last phase, through the last battle. Then the Earth Goddess witnessed that, which means that in his doubt he saw that actually he had accumulated all what he needed all the knowledge, concentration, merits that could allow him at this time to start his deepest meditation and try to really find the deepest meaning in his life and in life. Then he went on with his meditation, and then suddenly some other enemy attacked him. So Mara sent all the troop, all the, his army, to attack the Buddha, and they came, huge army, and they threw arrow to the Buddha. Of course, there was no Mara here, no army attacking the Buddha. Just that the hindrances did appear very strong, the last hindrances that he had to face. And when they came close to the Buddha, they just transformed into flowers and just came and fall at the feet and on the Buddha, just transform into flowers. Very nice, sweet stories, make nice paintings. What does it mean? Many paintings in Tibetan monasteries, when you see those flowers coming to the Buddha. So what does it mean? It is not said in his biography that the Buddha, through his power, like a kung fu man, you know, he just broke all the arrows and he was very strong. They just transform into flowers, which means that when doubt, desire, aversion are arising, through the deep quality of his mindfulness, they were transformed into flowers, into element of awakening. He did not need to fight them. He did not need to suppress them. He did not need to break them. That just through the power of mindfulness transform into flowers. Flowers which are just, in this sense, prizing his awakening. And I think that's quite important in the way of seeing the last battle of the Buddha, that all the enemies are transformed into flowers. Of course, there is no external enemy, there is only the inner enemies. And those inner enemies, they are not things that the Buddha could suppress or defeat. He had to include them, he had to receive them with mindfulness to transform them. There is no way that within one's own experience, I spoke about that last night, that one can refuse any aspect of oneself. And all those enemies were aspects of the Buddha's mind. Then he transformed those aspects which maybe were seen when they arose first as enemies, but he transformed them into wisdom, into flowers. Which means in our experience, there is never anything within ourselves which is arising that we need to defeat, we need to break, to suppress. If we can receive them with awareness and mindfulness, those elements are elements of our wisdom. Which come to say that desire, aversion, doubts, sleepiness, restlessness, when they can be experienced with mindfulness, they will be elements of wisdom. And they will lose their power of confusion. They will be no more. They will transform themselves and not be anymore doubt, confusion, restlessness, aversion and desire. As a very important element in our part, in the hero's journey, we see that he has to meet often wild beast, dragon and so on, that he had to fight, but he's always part of himself, he is meeting. So we are also, when we meditate, some people complain. In some meditation course, very interesting, people come and complain what's happening in their meditation, like if they were not responsible for that. You know, like if we were, I don't know, preparing things, we prepare something happening in the meditation, so we put some kind of experience in this corner, some other in the other corner, and then people come and say, I'm not sitting in a good corner because in my meditation what I just see is just anger, or what I experience in meditation is desire, or it is sadness or sleepiness. It's very interesting. You know, what can we do? I mean, you come here and you sit and you meet yourself. So whose fault is that? What can we do about it? Now, the way to express is sees already that the person expressing in this way has other expectations. I prefer to change of corner. I don't want the corner of aversion or the corner of sleepiness. Yet, our practice is just to be able to face those experiences with mindfulness. Because we will always meet in our practice those different elements. There may be some time of good concentration, things will not come, but we will learn from all those things arising and receiving with mindfulness. That's where what we learn from. We learn from all those difficulties. They are every time seeing us or teaching us some element of freedom. To be free within a state of mind which is not just perfect. So we may learn to transform those hindrances into flowers. And it's always difficult for most of us when we hear that, unless we start to see a little bit the skill, to believe it. So that's nice stories, you know, you transform that into flowers, but I tell you, when there is sleepiness, there is sleepiness, and when there is boredom, and it's not nice, it's just, you know, I just feel like rising and going out. And now I said, with mindfulness, you transform that into flowers. You know, that's nice, but first, how do you get mindfulness? That through our practice. Through everyday sitting, we come here and we all make, and you all make much effort to come here and sit. And I know for most of us, it's not just coming here and sitting in bliss. There is also, we all meet difficulties, yet we all come here and sit. Through this practice, then some element of mindfulness will develop, and then we'll take this magical power to transform things into flowers, into wisdom, into freedom. That our shadows we are meeting, and that we can recognize them and integrate them within ourselves, not keeping fragmentation and trying to push them away. Nearly is even not our shadow, is even closer to us. It's like our limbs, you know, our hands, our arm, our feet that we are meeting in our meditation and sometimes want to push away. In a sense, every time we are practicing mindfulness, we are sitting under a Bodhi tree. No need to wait till we are reborn in India and then go to Bodh Gaya and find this Bodhi tree. Every time we are sitting under the Bodhi tree. And every time we are sitting, there is some potentiality for freedom. We don't need to wait till we have accumulate so many years of practice or hours of practice. There is an element when an experience is arising, we don't cling to it and we just stay mindful. Already there is an element of freedom there. Then another experience is arising, they go very fast, and then if we can receive it with the same balance of mind, there is always an element of freedom. So why to wait till you are all in Bodh Gaya under this Bodhi tree? Every time we are seated, there is potentiality for freedom. Our wells of potentiality of awakening is always ours. It's not that we will get it from somewhere or at some other time. I think it's very important to value ourselves for having that. A sense of ultimate value that there is within each one of us, this mind which has all the potentiality of awakening. However, our manifestation may be sometimes we may go through some phases where there is more anger, more desire, more unbalance, more confusion, yet deeply within us there is this potentiality for awakening completely. Nothing is lacking in that. So the third aspect in the Buddha's life is a great struggle when he's under the Bodhi tree and he has to face all the difficulties. Not defeating them, but with mindfulness, welcoming every experience, transforming every experience into wisdom. Then the last part is his great awakening, when he is facing all the difficulties, all the hindrances, with a balanced mind and very quiet and stable mind. Then at this time he will see the nature, how he saw the nature of himself, the true nature of himself and the world. And at this time there was nothing to bind him, no more confusion, no more beliefs, no more concept to bind him. Then finally he reached the end of his road. Finally he owned what was always with him, that this astrologer saw when he saw when he was a very young a baby. He was fully awakened. Not that he got it from somewhere, he just stopped to cover it. He just stopped to bring confusion that he could not realize it. In the Tibetan tradition they have images that say, why do you go in the forest to look for the elephant which is in your garden? Something which is so near. It was even much more near, and then believing that it will be gotten from outside. After Buddha's awakening, then he started to teach for about 40 years. In many ways, he taught the truth. But when one reads his text, it's amazing that he did not speak much about nirvana, about ultimate freedom. He spoke more about suffering. He spoke much more about hindrances, about desire, about confusion, about all those things. And there's very little which is said about nirvana, about ultimate freedom. One may wonder why he did not tell us, you know, exactly a beautiful description of nirvana, you know, fantastic. Well, I think, imagine that you have a friend in a jail. And then you write letters to him. It's fantastic outside, you know, you can't imagine the forest and trees and the flowers, now they are nice. And so, is it helpful? What will the friends think, you know? Yeah, I know, it's nice. And no, they have, you know, clear, they've made a new forest and a new garden. That's fantastic. You will see after 20 years when you come out, you know, and there's a coffee shop there, you just enjoy the sunset. It's completely useless. Well, if you want to help your friend to get out of the jail, you may say, well, now you see, the door, the first door, is locked like that. And the key, you will find the key just under the third stone there. And the guardians, they always come at 6 in the morning, and there is half an hour where there is a shift of guardian, nobody is there. You're going to describe, you will describe all the, you make a very clear plan of the jail. And describe exactly what's happening. Be careful, don't go on the right even if the door seems bigger. This one is always locked, you know, go to the left, and then if you go in the back of the kitchen. So what the Buddha is describing is always a jail. He said, be very aware, know exactly how you are coating yourself. You are always going through the wrong door, and then you trap yourself, you go deeper in the jail. If you want to know exactly how you are kept like that, know exactly what keeps you in jail. So that's why he described so many times suffering and the cause of suffering. And people sometimes they think that Buddhism is a little bit sad and pessimistic, because just speaking about suffering, cause of suffering. But actually, in a sense, it's maybe very ambitious, because the Buddha, he taught the end of suffering. And if he's teaching about suffering, it's always for the sake of freedom, never for the sake of putting more people in jail. He doesn't give the plan of the jail to the guardians or to the policemen, he only gives to the people who are in jail, which is most of us. He was very skillful in teaching, always understanding what were the needs of the people coming in front of him. And if one reads the sutra, it's always amazing to see how he will adjust to whomever was coming in front of him. The other night I told you the story about this man who was about to sacrifice, you know, 1,000 animals. I would just say yes, about answering in a very simple way, that he was just answering the question. There are many other examples how the Buddha was skillful. It is said once that a monk was trying to meditate on the uncleanness of the body, which is one of the way of being mindful of the body, seeing that, you know, it's decaying, it's just, you know, getting worse and worse, and you can imagine a corpse and how it gets blue and green and just, you know, getting bad and bad, to get rid of the attachment to the body. One monk was meditating like that and he had no success. For him it was just hopeless to, you know, he would just sit and be very diligent, but it did not work. For him was no contact with his visualization and imagination of a decaying body. There was nothing interesting in that. Then his teacher came to the Buddha and said, what to do with this monk? You know, he has been meditating for so many years on the body and it doesn't work. Then the Buddha called the monk and he understood what was happening. So he just, with his imagination, he brought forth golden lotus made out of gold. And then he said to the monk, now you will contemplate that. And then slowly he saw how that was getting eroded, and how that was transforming, dust was coming in, and, you know, that was a transformation. Then through that, this monk could go into his meditation. Because it is said, he was a goldsmith before, and had connection with that, but he had no connection and no inclination to think about a dying body or a dead body. But imagining or thinking about a lotus flower, for him that was something which was connected. See how the Buddha could see the need of this monk. Another story which says that a young man came to the monastery to be a monk, and he just left behind himself a beautiful wife. So he was in the monastery, not so much his mind was in the monastery, he was always thinking about his beautiful wife home, you know. And he was very sad. And the other monks, so it's very sad, you see this young monk, he came and he every day feels so depressed, you know, what to do? I mean, that was very sad. And the monk, just this young man, was sitting there in the corner of the monastery. So they brought him to the Buddha. And the Buddha, if you see in the painting or the statue, he usually has some kind of white dirt here, which is called a urna, which according to tradition, he can bring light out of it, and then he can show some different area of this universe. He called the monk and he showed him the Deva land, where all those beautiful goddesses live. Then he saw so many beautiful women, much more than his wife, you know. That was so fantastic. So, well, his wife was okay, but that was really something much more fantastic. And then he was not so much anymore concerned going back home to his wife. Then? You see how skillful he was. Then, again the Buddha emanated some light, and that went to hell, to the place where people were suffering so much. And then he saw people there, and he saw why they had been reborn there, because they were so much burned by desire and they were led to wrong action through desire. Then after that, he said he really practiced meditation with much, of course, much diligence, and his mind was right into meditation. That another aspect of Buddha's skill in teaching or guiding his monks. Many stories when one reads the sutra, how the Buddha, not always so fantastic as this one, but more to see how the Buddha would usually guide not only his monks, but people who would come in front of him and ask questions. And always very respectful of the traditions the people were coming from. He never said to anyone, now you should leave your tradition and join the order. You know, some Brahmin would come and ask if they should go on making their rituals, and he would always say yes. You should practice your rituals, providing they were not sacrificing animals, which would be harmful. But he always said, yes, you can do that, and then he will maybe teach some mindfulness or something like that to help them to go deeper into the meaning of life. One Brahmin came once and asked the Buddha if he was Brahma. He started to ask questions, and then the Buddha very skillfully asked question back to the Brahmin and said, well, did you see Brahma? And he said, no. Well, maybe your father did. He said, no. And maybe your grandfather, no. So did anybody of your tradition, no, of your family or caste see Brahma? He said, no. Then he questioned him like that. That this Brahmin coming with a very clear question start to see that there was not a very deep ground to ask a question like that to the Buddha. Then the Buddha started to explain how one can get to higher and higher state of consciousness, to reach those states which are called Brahma states. And then teaching him that this Brahmin could experience for himself those states and know his tradition very deeply. Very skillfully, just asking questions, not saying you are wrong and, you know, I will tell you the truth. It's not like that the Buddha was receiving his people. Always very gently and not opposing anything, but sometimes showing that maybe one could go deeper, and there were maybe deeper meaning in life that what they were holding, that the truth would be. We are all engaged in this journey, so that's not only Buddha's awakening. In a sense, every time we also meet difficulties and also try to deal with them. We all need to bring renunciation in our mind and also mindfulness, and sometimes to be ready for the great struggle. Not fighting, but with a balanced mind, to transform things into flowers and to awaken, even if it is just maybe to the way that, or to know that I am thinking, or to know that I am sad, or to know that maybe I am upset. That's our way of going along through our journey. A journey to awakening. So we'll go on with our journey for the next 2 minutes, sitting under our Bodhi tree.